Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. And I want to say, as we record in later 2019, which is irrelevant, save for this time-related message, that Jews have been banning a lot of stuff, even off of the archive.org. Stuff that is ostensibly neutral over time ends up being Jewed. This is ultimately the reason we need the Learning College, so that you have access to the information Jews are trying to ban and to censor and suppress on every common public platform, YouTube, the social media, the news media, but even down to the literal archiving platforms that you would think would be neutral. So over time, stuff can move around, but if you ever needed to, you can always simply simply search my name, and I own alexlinder.com, .net, and what's the other one? .edu, maybe? I think only one of them is up, but I will always use those ultimately as a place to locate any material that has been banned everywhere else. But pending that, as long as the forum is up, and it's been up since 2003, so over 15 years, I will put what I record in the forum. Today, we're going to resume with Kevin MacDonald, The People That Shall Dwell Alone. We are in the middle of Chapter 7, Judaism as an Ecological Strategy, and we're going to do another 15 pages from that. So not a particularly long section, but let's dig in. This should be pages 309 to 326, basically, which is not the end of the chapter, but the penultimate section that we're doing of Chapter 7. A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy with Diaspora Peoples, by Kevin MacDonald, paperback edition. Chapter 7, Judaism as an Ecological Strategy, page 309, subtitle, Jewish/Gentile Differences in Fertility Patterns in Response to the Industrial Revolution. Differences in fertility patterns in response to the Industrial Revolution. Evolutionary perspectives on the demographic transition have emphasized the importance of fertility control and high investment parenting in achieving upward mobility in response to the altered conditions following industrialization. There is wide agreement that the Jews entered into the demographic transition earlier than Gentiles, and that Jewish fertility changed from being higher than Gentile fertility to being lower than Gentile fertility in the aggregate, citing Goldstein, Node, Ritterband, K-N-O-D-E. In general, the sharp drop in Jewish fertility coincided with emancipation and a consequent awareness, quote, of the opportunities becoming available to them for education, economic advancement, and generally better integration into the larger society. For example, Hyman summarizes evidence that 19th century Jews in France and Germany were practicing birth control, and that American and European Jews had lower birth rates than the surrounding population, even when controlling for education, urbanization, and social status. Alice Goldstein attributes the later age of marriage and the lowered fertility of German and Hungarian Jews to the prolonged education required for the typical Jewish occupations of white-collar worker and skilled craftsman. Moreover, the Jewish-Gentile difference was decreased, but not eliminated, when controlling for occupation. So, formerly Jews were in ghettos, mostly of their own choosing. They had large families, but then after they were given full legal equality and citizenship in the Goyish nations of Europe, and the Industrial Revolution came, 50 to 100 years following that emancipation. They began to have fewer children and invest more in them. There is evidence that the low fertility / high investment pattern of most Jews after the Industrial Revolution is more characteristic of Jews who are less traditionally religious, i.e., it's the Orthodox Jews. The more Orthodox they are, the larger families they have, and we find that in Israel and in America in 2019. Hyman, 1981, finds that a sample of French rabbis and cantors, who would tend to be the most observant Jews, had higher fertility than the mean for French Jews. Moreover, Goldscheider and Ritterband make the generalization that the highly traditional Orthodox and Hasidic Jews have higher fertility than other Jewish sects, and that, within Israel, fertility is higher among those who are religiously observant than among secular Jews. Similarly, Cohen and Ritterband find that religious service attendance was associated with fertility among American Jews in the 1960s. These data are compatible with the hypothesis that, by accepting secular education and maximizing investment in their children, non-traditional forms of Judaism function to enable Jews to compete economically in the wider society. There is evidence that Jewish populations adjust rapidly to the family patterns of the surrounding populations. For example, North African Jews migrating to France developed a pattern of having fewer children, marrying later, having a higher percentage of university graduates, and more frequently entering white-collar professional occupations than those immigrating to Israel. Della Pergola, 86. Moreover, while Ashkenazi groups within Israel have a higher fertility rate than those in European or American communities, immigration to Israel by Asian and African Jews tends to result in lower fertility and relatively delayed marriage compared to the country of origin. Within Israel, the result is a tendency toward convergence, creating a pattern intermediate between Jewish patterns in Europe and America versus the patterns in Africa and Asia, and in which ethnic differences among Jews are lessening. So they tend to take on the family characteristics of the surrounding population. The suggestion is that the general response of Jews to emancipation and the development of contexts in which upward mobility is possible has been to, quote, keep one step ahead of the populations they are living among by investing more in education, lowering fertility, and delaying marriage. Within Israel, Jews tend to marry later, have fewer children, and achieve higher levels of education than the co-resident Arab population. This suggests a pattern in which Jews are in direct competition with the host society and are able to manipulate their fertility in an adaptive manner relative to the social context by being able to track the investment patterns of the host society. This suggestion is an interesting parallel to the findings presented by Irons, who found a general tendency for groups to adjust fertility to local reference standards. Jews, however, appear to be tracking the investment patterns of an external group, the host society, and adjusting them accordingly in a manner that allows them to compete successfully with the host society. Here's what we need to do to stay ahead of these people, is how they look at it. Such a finding is highly compatible with the present conceptualization of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy, a team strategy, in competition with the host society. So they don't see themselves as part of the society, but as in competition with it, living off it, watching it, tracking its movements, and trying to beat it, defeat it, to take over it, to lead it, to mulk it, to parasitize it. High investment parenting is a critical aspect of this competitive strategy, but the amount of investment can be adjusted to local conditions, and at the same time, they're trying to destroy the families of the white competition through the institution of laws that now define the family court and such, so the easy divorce so that white families split up, and woman-favored laws so that the irresponsible party is given all the power to make the bad decisions. They're facilitating the making of bad decisions on the part of women. Essentially, this is their strategy for destroying white families while encouraging women to mate with non-whites. So attacking the very existence of the race. Congruent with the general interpretation of Jewish-Gentile competition, Patai notes a pattern in which Jews tend to excel in just those fields that were most highly regarded by the host country. For example, so that will get them higher status and higher income. For example, Jewish achievement in mathematics has been far more common in continental countries where mathematics is revered than in England, where Jews have excelled in the typically English pursuits of business. Similarly, Jewish excellence in music and the art has not been characteristic of Britain, while it has been characteristic of Germany and Russia. Moreover, Jews tend to win Nobel Prizes in precisely those areas where Gentiles of their countries excel. As Johnson notes regarding the success of Jewish student prize-winning prodigies in the late 19th century and early 20th century in France, quote, they beat the French at their own academic cultural game every time. Turning to 312, a new subtitle, Judaism and Personality Psychology. Epigraph. Two of them. When we offer sacrifices to God, we do it not in order to surfeit ourselves or to be drunken, for such excesses are against the will of God and would be an occasion of injuries and of luxury, but by keeping ourselves sober, orderly, and ready for our other occupations, and being more temperate than others. Flavius Josephus, Against Appian, 2.195. And again, Judaism asks, this is the mistake of the clever people, not intelligence, but, in the first instance, obedience. Magnus, 1907-78. MacDonald, apart from providing strong environmental pressure and genetic selection for intelligence, there is some reason to suppose that Jewish eugenics and cultural practices would also influence several personality systems, although the data are far from ideal. The personality system of conscientiousness is a biological system that underlies attention to detail, neatness, orderliness, striving for achievement, persistence toward goals in the face of difficulty, and the ability to focus attention and delay gratification. So these are one of four or five main personality gradients that they judge how conscientious you are. Another is extroversion, but we're starting with conscientious. There is a strong positive association between conscientiousness and academic success. And I had skipped over a sentence. At the extreme, such a person is obsessive slash compulsive and guilt-ridden. The scales of neat, careful of own work, persevering, and planful, all these in italics, load positively on this dimension, while irresponsible and careless of property load negatively. Correlations between high school grades and assessments of this factor performed 6 years previously were in the 0.5 range, so about 50% related. Similar correlations occurred for occupational status assessed when subjects were in their mid-20s. Eugenic practices related to ability in Jewish religious studies would clearly influence this trait. Studies of conscientiousness also indicate that this dimension includes items such as trustworthy, reliable, dependable, and responsible, which comprise what one might call social conscientiousness. Not consciousness, that's something else, that's communism. Social conscientiousness. Social conscientiousness appears to be a sort of don't let the group down trait, originally proposed by Darwin, 1871, as the basis of group allegiance. As Goldberg states, my knowledge of the status of person X on the trait of conscientiousness answers the question, can I count on X? Because of the importance of a sense of obligation to the group for Judaism throughout its history, there is reason to suppose social conscientiousness may be of particular importance to Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. Individuals high on this trait would be expected to feel intense guilt for having failed to fulfill their obligations to the group. Moreover, given the importance of conformity to group norms for Judaism, it would be expected that individuals who were low in this trait would be disproportionately inclined to abandon Judaism, while successful Jews who were the pillars of the community and thus epitomized the group ethic of Judaism would be disproportionately likely to be high on the group conformity and also likely to be reproductively successful. The result is that there would be strong selection pressures toward high levels of social conscientiousness within the Jewish community. And since social conscientiousness is psychometrically and presumably biologically linked to the other aspects of conscientiousness, these pressures would also result in a general trend toward higher levels of all aspects of conscientiousness within the Jewish community. For example, Jordan notes that Jews who defected during the Middle Ages and sometimes persecuted their former co-religionists tended to be people who were, quote, unable to sustain the demands of the elders for conformity. This trend may well have accelerated since the Enlightenment because of the cost of defection became lower. Israel, 1985, notes that after the Enlightenment, defections from Judaism due ultimately to negative attitudes regarding the restrictive Jewish community life were common enough to have a negative demographic effect on the Jewish community. Moreover, in Chapter 4, it was noted that there was discrimination within the Jewish community, such that the families of individuals who had apostatized or engaged in other major breaches of approved behavior had lessened prospects for marriage. To the extent that there is heritable variation for such nonconformity, and all personality traits are heritable, see Row 93, such practices imply that there will be strong selection pressures concentrating genes for group loyalty and social conformity within the Jewish gene pool. So they're breeding people who think alike, and they're training them to upon that basis, and enhancing and improving that basis continually. There has probably always been cultural selection such that people who have difficulty submerging their interests to those of the group have been disproportionately likely to defect from Judaism. So the ones who aren't like that, who don't fit the pattern, leave. Such individuals would have chafed at the myriad regulations that governed every aspect of life in traditional Jewish society. In Triandus's terms, these individuals are, quote, idiocentric people living in a collectivist culture. They are people who are less group-oriented and less willing to put group interests above their own. As in the case of intelligence, it is also highly likely that there were powerful environmental influences that facilitated the conscientiousness system. I propose, says MacDonald, that traditional Judaism, with its 613 commandments, positively facilitated the conscientiousness system. Barron, in 1952, writing of Jews in the ancient world, states that, quote, from the moment he awakened in the morning until he came to rest at night, his behavior was governed by the multiplicity of ritualistic requirements concerning ablutions, washing yourself, prayers, the type of food he was allowed to eat, and the time he should set aside for study. It was in this vast interlocking system of observances and institutions, more and more fully elaborated by his rabbinic teachers, that he found his most integrated way of living as an individual and as a member of society. So we're tempted to think in light, superficial political terms, oh, Jews are liberals, Jews are leftists, Jews are, you know, tolerant. No, they're totalitarian authoritarians among themselves. And this, as dumb or weird and odd as it is, enforces and creates an actual group that thinks the same way, has the same genes, and has the same outlook, and has the same culture. And this gives them a cohesiveness and a discipline that allows them to outcompete other groups like our Aryans. You understand? Thus, a child reared in a traditional Jewish home would have been strongly socialized to continually monitor his or her behavior to ensure compliance with a vast number of restrictions, exactly the sorts of influences expected to strengthen the conscientiousness system. Indeed, the popular conception of the Talmid Kokem scholar, T-A-L-M-I-D, K-H-O-K-H-E-M, Talmid Kokem, the scholar, the popular conception of the scholar, the Talmid Kokem, among the wider community of Eastern European shtetl Jews, and especially among the Hasidim, was that he was preoccupied with endless rituals and consumed with anxiety that he had neglected some regulation, citing Zborowski and Herzog. Zborowski and Herzog also describe individuals who are consumed with anxiety lest they omit opportunities to help others, since failure to take advantage of such an opportunity was a violation of a commandment. One function of the Hasidic rabbi was to reassure people who were anxiety-ridden because of the fear that they had violated one of the myriad regulations of rabbinical Judaism. Among modern Hasidim, too, anxiety disorders, or, quote, superego problems, unquote, are a common source of complaint. And one type of recognized deviance within the Orthodox community involves obsessive religious overconformity. Such individuals become completely preoccupied with religious rituals. Anxiety, the emotion of the conscientiousness system, is therefore a very salient psychological trait among those who represent ideal Jewish behavior in traditional societies, and thus among those who can be expected to have high social status and high reproductive success. Individuals such as impulsive, disinhibited people who find such requirements unduly burdensome would be prone to defect or to be excluded by the group, thereby concentrating genetic tendencies toward conscientiousness and social conformity among those who continued as Jews. Moreover, the nature of Jewish religious writings and their role in the Jewish community would constitute effective cultural selection for individuals with high levels of conscientiousness. We have seen that these writings are extremely difficult to comprehend, so that learning them undoubtedly involves a great deal of persistence, frustration, and delay of gratification. Also, there was little effort to make learning fun by having attractive subject matter. In the traditional Eastern European shtetl societies, studies began at age 5 or 6 with the Book of Leviticus and its very dull concern with laws and rituals, rather than with the colorful stories of other parts of the Tanakh. Boys of all ages were expected to put in long hours of study, and even children of age 3 had a 9-hour study routine. In the yeshiva, it was customary to sleep only 4 or 5 hours a night and devote the rest of one's time to study. There were powerful social pressures encouraging children to adopt this regimen of study and thus facilitating the conscientiousness system. Zborowski and Herzog show that in traditional Eastern European shtetl societies, children were exposed at an early age to the cultural ideal of scholarship. This is what they're doing while Goyish children are watching TV. The child's introduction to study was accompanied by an elaborate ceremony which indicated to the child the importance of this area of life, a custom also noted by Rabinowitz among the Jews of northern France during the medieval period. Books were revered, and the father's period of study was not to be interrupted with any noise. Children were shown the extreme respect accorded scholars when they came into the house. They themselves were usually named after an ancestor who was an illustrious scholar, and they were constantly encouraged to emulate the achievements of their illustrious relative. Family and community-wide ceremonies marked each advancement along the road of scholarship. The relevance of conscientiousness as a system underlying delay of gratification and perseverance in the face of hardship and difficulty is obvious. Conscientiousness is the system that impels people to continue their efforts in pursuit of a goal, even when the activity is not intrinsically rewarding and is filled with frustration and difficulty, hence every inducement to give it up. High frustration tolerance would appear to be a virtual necessity for coming to grips with these works, and we have seen that individuals who were relatively successful in mastering these works were also relatively likely to be reproductively successful. The ability to persevere and dominate, you know, that'll get you through law school and other places where words matter and attention to detail matters. There is also considerable evidence that traditional Jewish writing strongly advocated a generally responsible, sober, hardworking attitude toward life. Boys, and especially the children of the elite, were expected to refrain from rowdy and undisciplined activities. They were expected to never get their hands dirty or soil their clothes. Fighting was labeled as extremely un-Jewish, and even outdoor games were discouraged. Descriptions of children tended to note that, quote, their eyes were solemn, and that they, grin but do not smile. The physical ideal for an older child and an adult was to be thin and pale. What Zborowski and Herzog describe as, quote, a progressive etherealization, until he becomes the beautiful old man, pale, emaciated, aflame with inner light, the epitome of the complete and real Jew. Direct quote. Children were even scolded if they developed a physically strong, ruddy appearance, as we would expect of the Aryan youth. What we would call healthy to them is not something you want to be like. There was a very strong emphasis on the ability to delay sensual gratification. The books of Proverbs and Ecclesiasticus not only advocate education, but also praise psychological traits such as self-discipline and opposition to sensual gratification. There is a complete lack of any glorification of military virtues such as physical strength, courage, and aggression, which would be necessary virtues in an independently existing societies. Indeed, traditional Jewish religious rituals included practices that symbolized a rejection of military weapons. For example, during the Sabbath service, the pointer that was used by the reader of the Torah could not be made of metal because metal is used in making weapons. 3:18. This contrasts sharply with the biblical accounts in which the military exploits of men such as Samson, Jephthah, and King David were glorified. Swift, 1919, notes that during the First Commonwealth there were two ideals of manhood represented by craft and shrewdness, the thrifty herdsman and farmer, the shrewd merchant, the discerning and just judge, the crafty warrior, close quote, on the one hand, and by strength and courage, the stalwart and daring hunter and soldier, direct quote, on the other. However, in the wisdom literature, physical aggression is abjured, and Jews are advised to be obsequious to kings. Self-control is valued more than military might. Quote, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. Business, not military skill, is the route to influence. Quote, seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men. Proverbs 22:29. Neusner finds that the affective program of the rabbis during the classical period of Judaism was to encourage humility, patience, and self-abnegation. Some of the virtues may well be influenced by the conscientiousness system described above. There is a clear concern with being able to delay gratification in these writings. Patai considers delay of gratification to be a central Jewish value and cites data indicating that contemporary Jews are higher in this dimension. As noted above, the ability to delay gratification is psychometrically associated with conscientiousness. Since all personality systems show significant heritability, the eugenic practices emphasized here would tend to pull the Jewish community toward a higher level in these systems. As in the case of intelligence, traditional Jewish family influences would also be expected to pull in this direction. Interestingly, the Zionist movement emphasized a return to military virtues. Quote, instead of rabbis and sages, Zionism chose such figures as David or Judah Maccabee or Samson. This development strongly suggests that the omission of these virtues from the wisdom literature was intentional and filled the need to emphasize scholarship, diligence, and pursuit of tasks, a de-emphasis on sensory pleasure, and self-control as aspects of an instrumental strategy in the diaspora. This is the type we need to produce to survive and thrive in the diaspora. However, when confronted with the desire to establish a Jewish political entity, an independent state, there was a renewed emphasis on the military virtues. There is evidence, says MacDonald, for extremely intense relationships within the Jewish family. Alter, 1989, notes the image of the overpowering father in Kafka and the, quote, possessive, overbearing, guilt-inducing mother as a fictional type, as illustrated, for example, in the work of Philip Roth. Hertz and Rosen, 1989, 1982, describe emotionally intense relationships within the extended family, with frequent cutoffs of relatives who fail to conform to very high standards for participation in family events. The mother-child relationship is particularly intense and characterized by an extreme sense of self-sacrifice and the inculcation of guilt in the child. The child can never do enough to repay the mother's sacrifice. Parental love is intimately intertwined with parental sacrifice rather than with physical or verbal expressions of affection. The result is an intense motivation to please parents. Jewish children are expected to provide their parents with notches, i.e. desired rewards, in the form of achievement, financial success, and grandchildren, and the failure to provide them causes guilt. Quote, "Of course, there can never be enough notches, N-A-C-H-E-S, and their failure to provide enough inevitably results in guilt." This style of parenting is also apparent in the traditional Ashkenazi shtetl communities of Eastern Europe. We have already noted that the parents were extremely solicitous and self-sacrificing for their children, but Zborowski and Herzog also note that, while direct expressions of affection were never made after infancy, the children were, quote, "reminded constantly of all their parents have done and suffered in their behalf." And so that model somewhat applies to the Holocaust garbage. They invent an atrocity and then blame us. We're not doing enough to make up for this imaginary atrocity. They didn't suffer. We must pay them endlessly, more and more stuff. All the sacrifice, all the suffering, all the solicitude pile up into a monument to parental love, the dimensions of which define the vastness of filial indebtedness. Besides the inculcation of guilt, there is also some indication that Jewish family life is characterized by high levels of affection and solicitude combined with hostility. Zborowski and Herzog show that infants are showered with physical affection, including a great deal of kissing and caressing, and that afterwards, although physical expressions of affection are rare, parents continue to be extremely solicitous about the intellectual accomplishments and physical well-being of their children. However, there is also the suggestion that this self-sacrificing solicitude and affection are combined with high levels of anger and hostility directed toward the child. Alter notes that the image of the mother as characterized by overpowering affection, and even seduction, combined with domination and hostility in Jewish fiction. And Zborowski and Herzog, in their description of family life in traditional Eastern European shtetl societies, note that, in addition to extremely high levels of solicitude toward children, Jewish shtetl families typically engaged in heated arguments, a sort of domestic pill-pull, this hair-splitting debate, in which issues were intensely discussed and there were high levels of disagreement and anger. Mothers are likely to lash out in anger and impatience toward the child and oscillate quickly between intensely positive and intensely negative emotions directed at their children. Physical punishment performed in anger was not uncommon, and fathers appear to have been rather distant figures of respect, but not affection. Modern psychological research is highly compatible with the idea that parent-child relationships may indeed be characterized by intense affection combined with hostility, i.e. ambivalence, as in ambivalent attachment, since these emotions are associated with two independent biological systems. So that's why they can both be there. Citing himself, 1992. The ability to form close family relationships and engage in high-investment parenting is clearly an extremely important aspect of Judaism as an evolutionary strategy, but it is reasonable to suppose that being able to compartmentalize one's relationships is also a highly important skill. Being able to engage in close family relationships would thus be highly compatible with engaging in purely instrumental behavior toward other individuals outside one's group, including behavior of a hostile, exploitative nature. This type of flexibility would appear to be a general feature of human evolved psychology and thus common among all human groups, but the literary and ethnographic evidence suggests that Jewish family relationships very strongly facilitate both the affectional system and the ability to engage in aggressive and hostile interactions with others. These data on intense compartmentalized family relationships are also compatible with facilitating high levels of guilt. As indicated above, the emotion of guilt is associated with a conscientiousness system. You haven't done something you need to do. But there is excellent reason to suppose that this emotion could be exacerbated by combining intense affection with hostility within the family. The affectional system is fundamentally, that's AFF, fundamentally a motivational system, and intense affection and solicitude would motivate the individual to please the other person and would induce guilt feelings upon lack of compliance. The combination of intense affection and unreasonable, unfulfillable demands would be expected to produce intense guilt. Indeed, these unreasonable, unfulfillable demands may be seen as an aspect of hostility. The result would be a highly conflicted child, strongly motivated to comply with parental demands, and also highly motivated to reject these commands. Well, reject these demands, not commands. These findings are corroborated by Schifrin's study of group conversational style among American Jews derived from Eastern Europe. She describes very high levels of disagreement and verbal challenging among the speakers. Speakers continually competed to be heard and used exaggerated intonation and a very rapid tempo of speech. Unlike the case with non-Jewish groups, arguments developed even when the questions asked were non-controversial. Arguments did not end with consensus, but often simply shifted to a context of sociability and intimacy. Just as Borowski and Herzog portray the rapidly oscillating emotions of traditional Jewish shtetl mothers. So a pattern repeating that they learned in their families. Although these findings are restricted to Jews derived from Eastern Europe, Schifrin also notes the parallelism of this type of verbal argumentation to the style of the Talmuds, continual disagreement within an overall context of solidarity. This suggests a wider applicability of these findings to other Jewish groups. These findings also suggest that Jews tend to be high on the personality trait of affect intensity, i.e. they are prone to intense emotional experience of both positive and negative emotions. Individuals high in affect intensity have more complex social networks and more complex lives, including multiple and even conflicting goals. They are prone to fast and frequent mood changes and lead varied and variable emotional lives. Clinically, affect intensity is related to cyclothymia, i.e. alternate periods of elation and depression, kind of bipolar. Bipolar affective disorder, i.e. manic depressive psychosis, neurotic symptoms, and somatic complaints, somatic body, nervousness, feeling uneasy, shortness of breath. Affect intensity is also linked to creativity in the manic phase of bipolar affective disorder. Affect intensity is also linked to creativity and the manic phase of bipolar affective disorder. Consistent with the hypothesis that Jews are high on affect intensity, Sporosky and Herzog show that emotional extremes were typical of the inhabitants of traditional Eastern European shtetl communities. The Jewish holidays were intensely emotional affairs, and the emotions that were expressed were quite opposite ones, a sort of rhythmic alternation of extremes. Rapid emotional oscillation was also characteristic of Yiddish drama. However, there is also a strong emphasis on control, being able to exhibit intense contradictory emotions at the appropriate time. The common perception of Jewish and Gentile psychiatric workers from the late 19th century until at least the end of the 1920s was that compared to Gentiles, Jews, especially male Jews, had relatively sensitive, highly reactive nervous systems, thus making them more prone to the diagnoses of hysteria, manic depression, and neurasthenia. It's just oversensitivity, neurasthenia. Consistent with these early findings, Gershon and Leibowitz in 1977 find that Jews had a higher rate of hospitalization for affective disorder than did non-Jews in New York. strongly suggestive of a genetic basis for the greater prevalence of affective disorder among Jews. Is there finding that among Jews, bipolar affective disorder constituted a higher percentage of all affective disorder than was the case for in Gentile populations in the U.S. or Sweden? Individuals with bipolar affective disorder have periods of intense euphoria or paranoid anger, as well as periods of despondency, worry, and hopelessness, exactly the traits expected to characterize individuals who are extreme on affect intensivity. There is some indication that Jews tend to be extreme on all personality systems. Patai, 1977, P-A-T-A-I, one of his most common sites, provides a long list of personality traits which appear to be more pronounced among American Jews. Although this type of data must be evaluated with caution, the traits involved appear to include items from all of the five-factor personality dimensions, capital letters. Jews are high in all of the five-factor personality dimensions, says Patai, including items suggesting a strong tendency toward neuroticism, i.e., is more neurotic, or, quote, anxious, and extroversion, e.g., greater extroversion. Indeed, this pattern would be expected given the supposition that Jews are higher on affect intensity. Affect intensity is related to all personality systems with a strong emotional component and may be viewed as a behavioral energizing system that can be directed toward behavioral approach related to extroversion, as well as behavioral avoidance and attention to danger related to neuroticism and conscientiousness. Individuals high in affect intensity are thus highly motivated to intensive interaction with the environment and often have conflicting goals because both behavioral approach and behavioral avoidance systems are prone to activation. Thus, the proposal is that a critical component in Jewish adaptation has been the elaboration of affect intensity as a personality system. The suggestion is that via processes of cultural and natural selection, Jews have developed an extremely powerful set of psychological systems that are intensely reactive to environmental contingencies. Personality systems underlie a set of adaptive interactions with the environment. See McDonald, he cites himself. Behavioral approach systems direct us toward active, highly motivated involvement in the world, risk-taking, and the acquisition of resources and stimulation. On the other hand, behavioral avoidance, including the conscientiousness system, underlies the ability to react intensely to anticipated danger, delay gratification, persevere in unpleasant tasks, and be dependable and orderly. Another personality system influenced by affect intensity is the affectional system, often termed agreeableness, warmth, or love in personality research. Influenced by affect intensity. This system underlies the ability not only to form close, intimate relationships related to high investment parenting, but also other types of long-term relationships of reciprocity, trust, and sympathy. Citing Buss and Wiggins and Broughton. Such a trait would appear to be critical to membership in a cohesive, cooperative group such as Judaism. In this regard, it is of interest that Jews exhibit low levels of antisocial personality disorder, a disorder linked to being low in the agreeableness system. So Jews are not antisocial, except their policies are anti-white and antisocial, but they themselves are high on getting along in order. They have trust within group. Evolution, like a good engineer, designed people with good engine, the behavioral approach system, and good set of brakes, behavioral avoidance and conscientiousness, says McDonald. Individuals who are very high in all of these systems are likely to have a great deal of inner conflict, also noted by Patai as a trait of American Jews, since they are pulled in different directions by these biologically and psychometrically independent systems. Exemplars would be the sort of fictional characters who populate Woody Allen movies. Individuals who have very powerful drives toward resource acquisition, social dominance, and sensual gratification, but who also have a high level of anxiety, guilt, and inhibitory tendencies. all personality systems are adaptively important, and being high in all of them provides the ability to be flexibly and indeed intensely responsive to environmental contingencies. An individual who was high in both the behavioral approach systems and the conscientiousness systems would be strongly motivated to engage in highly rewarding approach behaviors, including extroverted behavior related to resource acquisition, social dominance, and sensual gratification aspects of behavioral approach, but would also show an ability to react intensely to threaten danger, delay gratification, persevere in the face of difficulty, and be dependable and orderly aspects of behavioral avoidance and conscientiousness. This perspective is compatible with the findings of Watson and Clark, 1992, indicating that high scores in the achievement facet of the NEO personality inventory, Costa and McRae 85, are associated not only with extroversion, but also with the conscientiousness facets of orderliness and dependability. Since Jews have generally been very high achievers, it would be expected that they would be high at both of these traits. Moreover, the data cited above, indicating that Jewish families have intense family relationships characterized by contradictory emotions, are quite compatible with this perspective, since the suggestion is that there are intense socialization processes within the Jewish family directed at different biological systems underlying qualitatively different interpersonal relationships. Although the hypothesis that Jews are high in all personality systems requires further study, Patai's suggestion is compatible with the general point of this section. There have been powerful eugenic and cultural selective forces that have acted on personality systems within the Jewish community over historical time. And that's the end of today's. And we see that yet another aspect in which Jews have shaped themselves into having in-group loyalty. And yeah, there's a lot of disagreement and hostility, but there's also a lot of love and a lot of investment in their family. And so as they build themselves into an in-group, out-group mentality, culture, and gene set. I've been Alex Linder talking to you and reading to you from A People That Shall Dwell Alone by Kevin MacDonald, the paperback version with Diaspora Peoples as its front paper. From copyright 2002. You can find everything we record at VNN Forum or one of my other sites. And thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from Kevin MacDonald real soon.